If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Court Appointed is meant to be for entertainment purposes and basic legal information only.
Nothing in this podcast should be considered as legal representation nor legal advice.
Only use the knowledge presented herein to dazzle your friends or possibly win bar trivia.
Dr. Lawyer, Indian Chief. For my likely songs of grief with the yellow fear and fearless eyes. It's them for all the times I've tried.
I'm your co-host, Riley Smurl, a pre-law student with an interest in all things legal and illegal.
And I'm your other co-host, Tommy Smurl, and I am just your dad.
That's pretty good.
Got you there, didn't I? I bet you thought I was going to say I was just a dude, but I'm just your dad. If you'll bear with us, as you notice, we still have the same disclaimer and intro music and setup as we did before, so it'll take a little while before we can get everything straightened out. So we're kind of under construction for the next couple weeks, but we didn't want to neglect bringing new episodes. So we're here again with a new episode.
And we'll get there eventually. We'll get a good disclaimer.
That's right. A good disclaimer and find some good music. With probably the most consistent complaint I've had about our podcast over the years is the music. I don't know why, but people are hating on our music sometimes.
Well, now's a perfect time to get new music.
But at least they knew it was us, you know?
That's true. That podcast with the music I really hate.
That's right. But we'll try to find something. I don't know. You can't please everyone. But we'll find something and we'll just, you know, tick you off in a different way.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this week for our topic that we have to cover is about the laws that are either have been passed or are being considered that cross politics and science, and they kind of go against each other in a way. And we have to figure out, is that a good thing? Is it good to conflict science and politics?
Basically, is it good for people who have no scientific background to decide that scientific experts should not be able to make the science rules?
Well, that's true, but others would argue that these are the elected officials, the ones put there by the people, and they should have the knowledge to decide whether these things are in the public interest or not.
Well, I suppose that's one way of looking at it. What bill was it that was local, Dad, that was going on here that we saw that made you want to talk about this?
Well, we have that was recently passed in the West Virginia legislature, Senate Bill 12, and that allows elected members of city councils and county commissions to vote on whether they want to allow health department regulations to exist. So, you know, who's in charge of the health department?
I mean, science. Health experts,
doctors,
scientists.
Yeah, doctors and scientists who should be issuing health edicts for the good of the public. And yet here we've got elected officials that are going to be put in charge of deciding if they like what they're saying or not.
Yeah. Basically, it says the appointing authorities of the county boards of health have to approve or disapprove all ordinances and rules passed by the board. So, and then I thought this was interesting. This is something that I actually have learned about in a class, in an administrative law class I'm in. We talked about the inform and comment period in like federal policy making or state policy making, where federal agencies and state agencies need to put out the new laws they're going to make and new rules and mandates and have to allow the public to comment on them for a certain amount of time. And this was like a big thing back in the day when there were all sorts of FDA things going on about foods and things you could and couldn't get or buy or eat, and people wanted to be able to comment on them. So this is also a part of it. And now boards of health have to post their rules in the state register and then have to have a 30-day public comment period for people.
Well, the thing that gets me about it is that, you know, you do hope that your people that are your scientists, your doctors that are making these decisions, they're the ones, first of all, they were put there by the county commission. So it's not like this was just some guy they found on the street and nobody else wanted the job. The county commission has already okayed these people to be in this position. And then you're going to turn around and second guess them?
Yeah.
As far as whether you like that or not. And it has very political, it smacks of politicizing things.
It does.
It's like, you know, that guy's ruining all our fun. We don't want to wear masks and we don't want to have to social distance. And I felt like a lot of it associated back to that, that they didn't want the health department to be able to put out edicts that they thought interfered with business or they weren't in favor of, or they don't believe the science.
Yeah. I think it's very telling that there's even specific language in there that in a public health emergency, rules can immediately go into effect, but the appointing agencies still are able to approve or disapprove of it within 30 days. So, you know, there's a public health emergency, like say a pandemic, and a board health department can put this rule into place immediately. But I mean, then the appointing agency could then vote in a week and say, we don't like that. We're going to get rid of that. So something like a mask mandate or a quarantine period or anything like that, social distancing, capacities for people being in restaurants and stuff like that.
One of the people in the Senate voting on it questioned one of the other ones that was a physician, and this person was in favor of this, and the one that was against it was the one questioning him, said, now, you know, I'm a businessman and I'm on the county commission, and I'm going to have the power to decide whether you as a doctor can submit something to be done. Are you sure you're good with that? You know, do you want to live with that kind of thing?
And the doctor wanted that? The doctor voted for it?
Yeah. Yeah. I have to say that it was probably more politically motivated than it was logically motivated.
Yeah. It is. I mean, they try to mention other things in this article I'm reading about it, and the various legislators that voted on it, talking about things like smoking in public places and protecting people from secondhand smoke, or, you know, in West Virginia, we have a big opioid crisis going on, things that have to do with like harm reduction programs and how we've been handling helping people with addiction issues. But I mean, really, this came about because of the pandemic.
Well, that's what I felt. There's two main issues in play here. One is the mask situation, people not agreeing with the mask situation. They're wanting someone to do something about it.
Yeah.
But the other one is there's a running battle going on right now between health departments and city governments with these needle exchange programs. The health department, the science will show you that these needle exchange programs reduce like your instances of HIV breaking out. They reduce hepatitis and different other diseases that are transferred through dirty needles. But cities have a different view of it. They look at it and they see it as encouraging people to do drugs. You're enabling them by giving them these needles. And they don't like that. They are against it because they go around and they pick up all these needles and they see all these drug addicts coming and going and say, well, you're just encouraging them. And the fact is, though, they have to come in and register to get these needles. And they're constantly, you know, being prodded on, do you need help? We have services available and we're going to help. We want to try to help you. And, you know, hopefully people hit rock bottom. And if they've got the right people there saying we can help you, then they don't die from this. And I think that a lot of people in the general public just think, you know what? They're trying to kill himself. Let them kill himself.
Yeah.
And they don't really care about it. They think that's one less. And probably, you know, a lot of these people, the only time they would think differently is if that was one of their family members that was addicted.
Yeah. And I mean, this seems to me like it's a very, I don't want to say uniquely West Virginian, but maybe Appalachian mindset, because you have places like Oregon that just decriminalized all drugs pretty much and made it so possessing them and using them is no longer a crime and you can't be arrested for it, but they can either fine you or they can take you to get help, take you to get treatment. And I feel like that sort of approach to it, to helping people and focusing on reducing the number of people that are struggling with addiction, is probably a better way of going about it. But it seems like bills like these are more focused on just trying to make it so how public health officials think we should help people with addiction is overturned by politicians.
Yeah, because, I mean, this isn't a choice. People don't choose to be addicted, and they don't just do drugs to have fun. They've become addicted, and it's a disease.
Mm-hmm.
And you've just got to break it. And the only way to break it is the person has, first they've got to want help, and then you got to have help available.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if we decide as a society we're willing to throw all those people away, then what does that say about us as a society?
Yeah. And I think that's especially ironic because I don't know if you saw this, but the chairman of the health committee in the West Virginia State Senate said this bill came about after egregious actions taken by some county health boards during the pandemic. So reading that, I'm thinking, okay, maybe mask mandates or closing down businesses, stuff like that, that they didn't agree with. But these egregious actions that they're talking about are... One of them was Monongalia County in West Virginia deciding to prohibit Pennsylvania residents from buying liquor in West Virginia because Pennsylvania had closed its liquor stores and it had higher rates of the virus, but West Virginia left ours open. We considered those essential. So
they are, by God.
Yeah. So, you know, people up by those other states buy what Pennsylvania, so we don't want them coming here to buy liquor because we don't want them bringing the virus into our state.
That makes too much sense.
And the other was... vape shops in the Eastern Panhandle were classified as non-essential. So they were shut down. And those were two of the egregious actions cited as reasons that we need to be able to have politicians in charge of health issues instead of county health boards.
Now, fortunately, they had tried to, you know, you'd think it was just on things that had come up recently that they wanted to be able to address.
Mm-hmm.
But what really surprised me is that in this bill, they were saying there was a grandfather clause. Things that were already established are established. You can't put those now, go back and put those in front of the county commission and let them decide.
Right.
But they tried to add an amendment to make it anything that had passed within the last 10 years. And what they were looking to do was overturn some of the no smoking ordinances, which everywhere in America right now, pretty much they've eliminated smoking indoors in almost all circumstances. And there were people that were looking at that from a financial standpoint, which goes completely against the public health, to overturn some of these smoking laws.
Yeah. I mean, this even mentions specifically that smoking and secondhand smoke exposure are two of the leading causes of preventable death and disease in West Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I mean, we have lots of smoke-free places. I would say actually this is a place where you're hard pressed to find a place that does allow smoking that's not your own home.
Well, I think you can do it in places that are considered bars, can't you? Or not?
No,
that's eliminated too.
I haven't been
to a bar in so many years.
I've been in, like, I guess bars, not 21 and only bars, but 18 and over bars, and you can't smoke in there. Huh. You can't even vape in there, and that's they've also added those restrictions to a lot of places like hospitals and schools and stuff like that.
I mean, I go to restaurants that serve drinks,
right,
but not just places that are strictly bars,
right,
that I could think of. So
yeah,
I wasn't sure. I know you don't encounter it like we used to.
Mm-hmm.
You'd encounter smoking everywhere. I remember when they used to smoke on planes and you stuck all the smokers in the back of the plane. And I don't know what that was supposed to do because eventually it all rolled up front.
It's all going to make it up front.
Yeah. So, I don't know, they thought they were downwind or something. I'm not sure.
Man, I can't even imagine that.
But one of the biggest thing that that I thought really points out to it. It says the bill is opposed. Now, I mean, it's opposed, but it's already been passed. The bill is opposed by several groups, including the American Cancer Society, the Association of Local Health Departments, and the County Commissioners Association of West Virginia. So at least the county commissioners have gotten or smart enough to say, hey, look, we don't want this responsibility. Don't put this on us. And then they're also sending it to city council people. Mm-hmm. And I'll tell you the truth. I've known about city council people for a long time, and I don't have a lot of faith in their ability to make judgments on things like my health.
Yeah.
But, you know, and I'm always going to be on the side of the American Cancer Society.
Mm-hmm.
I have never known them to be ones that dabbled in fake science or anything.
Yeah. And I mean, when I'm electing someone to state government or city council or something, maybe this is just me, but I don't expect them to be public health experts. They're going into a public service role, which I assume will have stuff to do with like other policies that have to do with infrastructure and funding and taxes and all that kind of stuff. I don't expect them to know how to best protect the public health, and that's what state health departments are supposed to be for. That's why we have these smaller entities that are experts in those things, because we can't expect politicians to be experts in everything.
That's exactly right. Although there's a lot of them that'll tell you they are.
Yes. Lots of them.
They're experts at everything.
Yeah. After how Rand Paul talked to Dr. Fauci, I think he would think he's knows everything he needs to know about science and masks.
Well, Rand Paul, if I remember correctly, he is a doctor, but I think he's a dentist or something.
Is that right?
But even if he's not a real doctor, I don't think he's practiced much medicine in the last 20 years or so.
You're right. He is a physician. Wow. I did not. He went to the Duke University School of Medicine. Yeah. He began practicing ophthalmology.
Ophthalmology, yeah.
But he withdrew from the American Board of Ophthalmology and declared himself self-certified by his National Board of Ophthalmology.
Huh.
So that's interesting.
What, the Board of Ophthalmology of Paul?
It says by his National Board of Ophthalmology.
It has a membership of one.
It says Rand Paul.
I'm going to certify myself an expert in something.
Wow. It was never accepted as an accrediting entity by organizations like the American Board of Medical Specialties. Its certification was considered invalid by lots of hospitals and insurance companies. Only 50 or 60 doctors were ever certified by the National Board of Ophthalmology.
Hmm.
And then it was dissolved a year after it was incorporated.
Yeah.
But wow.
He's a doctor, so he had every right to question Fauci.
Right.
And what did Fauci know about why are vaccinated people still wearing masks?
Yeah.
And I'll tell you the truth. My feeling on that is either the vaccine works or it doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
If it works, then that means we shouldn't be catching the virus.
Or
even
giving
if we
it to
come
people.
In contact. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. We shouldn't be active with the virus at any point, whether it's making us sick or making others sick.
Mm-hmm.
I really believe, though, the problem is, there's a lot of yahoos out there that they see people without a mask and they'll say, well, by God, I'm not going to wear a mask in.
Well, they already say it now with everyone else wearing masks.
Yeah, they're doing that anyway. So if we take them off, everybody's going to take them off.
Yeah.
And that's what they're afraid of. They can't trust the public for any common sense. If they said, if you're fully vaccinated, you don't have to wear a mask, people would just say, well, they'll never know.
Yeah.
My first dose. I don't have to wear it. Or they'll say, I've got an appointment next month. I don't need to wear my mask anymore.
They'll walk into Walmart without their mask on. Just tell them I'm fully vaccinated.
Yeah.
And how can you check?
You can't tell who's who.
Yeah. You expect someone to have their vaccination card on them at all times, I guess. But then, I mean,
and what
that
really,
doesn't always work.
What really blows my mind is there's people that are eligible to get the vaccine and they don't go get it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when you read in the paper, we've been doing vaccines for, what, 2 months now?
No, longer than that.
Longer than that, 3 months?
Since December. So 3 months.
Has it been that long? Mm-hmm. And so if you're in the upper age group, in pretty much every state, mm-hmm. the upper age group went first. So if you're 89 years old and you catch COVID now, you haven't gotten the vaccine, you don't have anybody to blame but yourself.
Well,
I mean, it was available.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, especially here in West Virginia, we've been rolling out that vaccine like crazy.
Yeah. They couldn't get enough, you know, 85-year-olds in there. So eventually now they've opened it up to everybody, 16 and over.
Mm-hmm.
No waiting list. I mean, there is a waiting list, but I mean, right. you don't have to hold off from your chance. You just schedule it and go. And, you know, that's great. That's what they need to do.
Yeah. And I mean, the vaccines are all 100% effective against death from COVID and serious like hospitalizations from COVID, which I think is the important thing that, you know, you cannot wear a mask around. If you're vaccinated around unvaccinated people, you're not going to get it. You're not going to, you know, give it to them in the sense that they won't die if you give it to them, or you won't die if you get it. If you're vaccinated, you aren't going to be hospitalized. But I guess there is that question that this is so new and these vaccines have only been available for 3 months. How high is the risk of it being transmitted asymptomatically or very low symptoms, very small symptoms, but still being transmitted? So I think keeping those masks on is a way of telling people, like, yes, we have vaccines, but this doesn't mean you can go out and go to concerts and go to big parties and stuff like that. We're not there yet, but we will be.
Yeah, but one thing, though, I think that people think that not having it and being asymptomatic are the same thing.
Yeah, that's true.
And they're not.
They're not.
I mean, if you have the vaccine and you don't get the disease, you're not asymptomatic.
Yes.
If you are asymptomatic, you're not showing any symptoms of the disease.
But you have it.
But you have mm-hmm. it, and you can actively spread it to others that may show symptoms mm-hmm. of the disease. And I think people put those in the same category.
Yeah.
And that's not the case. So if you're vaccinated, you're in a different level than someone who's asymptomatic.
Mm-hmm. It's definitely a public health issue that I would attribute to state health departments and doctors that I trust with my health.
Yeah, and that, you know, it definitely falls to the states. While the federal government kind of has authority, but kind of doesn't have authority,
mm-hmm.
it derives its authority for isolation and quarantine from the Commerce Clause of the U.S. Constitution, which, if you've been a longtime listener of this podcast, you've heard the Commerce Clause mentioned in a lot of different situations. And while I thought that was Santa Claus's brother that handles the money at the North Pole,
not Commerce Clause.
evidently, it's not. Evidently, it's something that takes place because of the U.S. Constitution. And mm-hmm. what it says is that the government has power over things that affect interstate commerce.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how they come in and govern. So under Section 361 of the Public Health Service Act, the U.S. Secretary of Health and Human Services is authorized to take measures to prevent the entry and spread of communicable diseases from foreign countries into the United States and between states. The authority for carrying out these functions on a daily basis has been delegated to the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control. So what it's saying is that people coming in, the federal government has a say-so over mm-hmm. how they are handled.
Mm-hmm.
And then it also says between states.
Right.
They could issue a mandate that says, you know, Florida is overrun with COVID. Lock down the borders of Florida and don't let anybody out.
Right.
You know, or something like that. It's within their power to do that.
Well, I mean, yeah. It's like how a crime that crosses state borders then is a federal crime.
Mm-hmm.
The federal government, you know, prosecutes a crime. You cross the border from West Virginia to Ohio. They can do the same thing.
Now, the CDC's role under 42 Code of Federal Regulations, Part 70 and 71, the CDC is authorized to detain, medically examine, and release persons arriving into the United States and traveling between states who are suspected of carrying these communicable diseases. As part of its federal authority, the CDC routinely monitors persons arriving at U.S. land border crossings and passengers and crews arriving at U.S. ports of entry for signs or symptoms of communicable diseases. So they have the right to govern that. They just don't have the right to override states or force states into police actions.
Sure.
Because the states have their decision as to whether they want to follow those guidelines or not, but they certainly would issue the guidelines.
Yeah. That is interesting to me, though, because, I mean, under the Constitution, states have the power to self-govern. You know, they have their mm-hmm. own powers. They don't have to do everything the federal government says, just like you said. But in a way, the state government, like, layout and hierarchy was designed after just, like, a smaller version of our federal government. Except it's broken down for every state. So you would think the federal government now has come to a point where they've decided things like we are going to let the CDC handle isolating and examining people who might have a communicable disease or who are traveling between states, and we have the authority to do that, but we're going to pass that down to the CDC because they're the experts. We're going to let them take care of that. We're not going to, like, tell our senators to, or our president to do that. That's we're going to pass it down to the people who know what they're talking about. So you would think the states would do the same thing. That, you know, even if they want to self-govern, okay, but, like, then follow the pattern of passing it down to the people who know what they're talking about.
Well, you would think that when the president is putting someone in charge of something as important as a public health, that it's someone that we should have confidence in.
Mm-hmm.
And what they say, we should trust. And, you know, that's one of the things that they say now, looking back, is that wearing masks and a lot of other protocols that were trying to be put in place by Fauci and, you know, the CDC, that those did not, we had a lot more people die than needed to.
Right.
Because that whole process was politicized. It was like, well, you just do that. That's just the liberals that want to wear those masks. If, you know, real Americans, they shouldn't have to wear masks. It's in the Constitution. I don't have to wear a mask. Mm-hmm. Well, no, it's not in the Constitution.
That's not in there.
No, they didn't write that in there specifically.
Thomas Jefferson didn't think about that one.
No, that was not one of the thoughts that they had. Now, one of the things that's important to note is the difference between an isolation and a quarantine situation. Isolation separates people known to be ill from those people who are not sick. Quarantine separates and also restricts the movement of people exposed to a contagious disease, but not yet ill, to see if they become sick. So, they, you know, when they issue these things, a lot of people think isolation and quarantine are the same thing, but they're actually two different things. So, if you're isolating the people that are sick, then you're quarantining the people that aren't sick.
Right.
And unfortunately, though, the problem is we don't have a very good way to enforce that.
No.
You know, you had like this one sheriff in this one county said, we're not going to enforce mask mandate. Mm-hmm. I don't care if you call us and complain people aren't wearing masks. We're not going to enforce it.
Yeah.
And, you can fine people. There, in some cases, there are some things on the books that say you can go to jail. But I think one of the biggest problems is that, say, most cities, most states, they have quarantine isolation laws that are 40 to 70 years old.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody updated the plan. I don't think anybody really planned that something like this could ever happen.
Well, the last one was 100 years ago, so anyone that currently is in any sort of political position of power wasn't around the last time it happened. Well, we don't have any of those people.
I don't know.
Well,
there's a few. Has Mitch McConnell
Mitch McConnell
been there that
is
long?
Probably around here in influenza pandemic.
He survived the Spanish
1918.
Flu.
Yeah.
And the coronavirus. He's doing pretty good.
Yeah, I guess so.
No wonder he looks like a turtle.
I mean, even like states that aren't willfully neglecting following through on quarantine or isolation laws. I look at a place like New York for a while, and maybe even still, I'm not sure. They had a rule that, you know, if you travel to certain states that had really high rates of infection, you had to quarantine when you returned to New York for 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And
they wouldn't let people from Florida in for a while because Florida was doing so bad. So if you were from Florida, they wouldn't let you into New York.
Right. But I mean, in a city as big as New York and a place as big as New York, how are you ever going to enforce that every single person that crosses the state's border or into the city, and you know exactly what state they came from or how long they were there, how are you going to ensure that they stay in their homes for 2 weeks?
Yeah, there's no way.
There's just no way to do that.
You don't have the people or the money to be able to do that.
No.
And you would, all you could do is just grab the ones you see here and there. You know, there's no way that you could catch them all.
No. Just like Pokemon.
Yeah.
You got to catch them all. But you can't catch them all.
Be like that joke I heard about the state trooper that there was a string of cars driving down the interstate speeding, and this trooper pulled out and came up behind the one in the rear and pulled him over. And the guy was just upset. He was like, didn't you see all those other ones that were driving there too? How can you justify just pulling me over and letting all them go? And he said, well, let me ask you something. He said, you ever been fishing? He said, sure, I've been fishing. He said, did you ever catch one? He said, sure, I've caught them before. He goes, did you ever catch them all?
No, Dad. Was that so much a joke? Or like an analogy.
That's a life lesson.
Yeah.
An analogy. See, look, you're using legal terms on me now. You're. It's not a joke. It's an analogy. Your Honor, I have an analogy I would like to submit.
I would like to compare catching fish to pulling speeders over on the road.
In 2014, the Congressional Research Service wrote about quarantines and the federal constitution when there were concerns about the Ebola virus. In general, the research service said that the power to take quarantine measures is reserved to the states under the 10th Amendment. In 1824, Supreme Court Justice Chief Justice John Marshall, the namesake
of my university.
Beloved, that's right, our beloved university.
Our beloved university.
In his opinion, in Gibbons v. Ogden, drew a clear line between the federal government and the state governments when it came to regulating activities within and between states. Marshall's reasoning set the precedent that police powers are reserved to states for activities within their borders, with some exceptions. Those police powers include the ability to impose isolation and quarantine conditions. Marshall wrote that quarantine laws form a portion of that immense mass of legislation which embraces everything within the territory of a state not surrendered to the general government. So, you know, if there's any question about is there power by the states to actually enforce these things, yes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Supreme Court has ruled they do have the power to enforce those.
Yeah.
Just federal government can't come in and do that unless it concerns intrastate travel.
Right. You know? I think it's interesting when you look at like decisions like that and more recently the you had mentioned the Public Health Service Act. A lot of those things, which if I'm correct, was that in like the early 2000s?
Yes.
Like 2002 or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of those were because of terrorist attacks, like because of the anthrax attacks in 2001. They created all these powers for state health departments because they realized like if something like this happens and there's some bioweapon or whatever that's released, we need more of a delegated power system of states being able to do these things and take control of these things, because it's impossible for the federal government, obviously, to handle these things, because they realize, like with the anthrax case in 2001, we don't have the ability to take care of all this. We couldn't handle this if this were bigger. So that was why things like that came about, was because we thought the next issue that would happen like this would be a terrorist attack. We didn't even, there was no mention of like a pandemic or a public health emergency from a naturally occurring communicable disease. I'm sure that was in there somewhere, but that was where this came from, was terrorist attacks. And they came up with these six functions of state health departments that they specifically said were to fulfill the job of the state to protect the public health in developing policy, legal compliance, partner engagement, like between education and engagement with like the state or a health department, stuff like that. Continuous improvement, oversight, and resource stewardship. So like making sure there are adequate legal, financial, technological resources to perform these public health services. So all of these were created so that states could protect the public health in any sort of emergency.
Because states are all set up differently.
Mm-hmm.
So the federal government realized they couldn't do a cookie cutter thing. This is what you'll do, because then you'd have somebody say, well, we don't do that this way, or
right.
We have this, we have that. So it has to be up to the individual states.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure that some took that more serious and did a better job than others did.
Sure. Yeah.
I mean, that's just the way it's going to work when there's human beings involved.
Right. So. And politics, I guess.
Yeah. And politics. Now, there are precedents where courts have ruled that states or local governments didn't meet a burden of proof to justify a quarantine. For example, in 1900, courts ruled against the city of San Francisco when it tried to inoculate and then quarantine Chinese residents against the bubonic plague when the courts had doubts that the plague conditions existed. So the bubonic plague broke out in Chinatown in San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this was what they did. And, you know, if we did an episode on this one other time that where we covered it, there was at one point there were actually laws in place that made it legal to discriminate against people of Asian descent.
Mm-hmm.
Chinese Exclusion Act was one of them.
Well, it was probably around like World War II, right? Like that sort of.
Well, it was really prior
period.
To that.
Really?
Yeah, we didn't even allow Asian people to apply to come here for a while.
Wow.
And it wasn't until I think about the 30s or 40s that we finally allowed them to come here. It might have been after World War II, I mm-hmm. guess. But at the time this bubonic plague broke out in Chinatown, well, they basically quarantined it off. But if you weren't Chinese, you could leave. It was just they kept all the Chinese inhabitants mm-hmm. in there and basically said, look, you all just stay in there and it's either going to get cleared up or you're all going to die from it and then it'll clear up. So they wow. wouldn't let them out. They made them live in there amongst it. And that's when the federal government had to step in and say, look, this isn't, if it were a real quarantine, right. you wouldn't let people leave just because they're white.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so they stepped in and overruled that. So. Mm-hmm. That was a false, you know, they were doing right. that. They're being discriminatory.
It's racism.
Yeah.
Yeah. That is interesting, though, because in this pandemic, we've seen that countries like China, that was kind of their isolation policy, their way of managing it and making it so they got back to a sense of normalcy pretty quickly, was they kind of put everyone that tested positive for COVID or was exposed in one place and said, you know, either you recover or you don't, and they had a lot of death because of that. But that's ironic that that's what Americans thought we should do to people of Asian descent, and that's kind of how China at least has managed
their own
isolation. Mm-hmm.
But did you see some of the video from some of the early days of it before we really had it here mm-hmm. and it was over there?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they were beating people with clubs to get them to go back in their apartments, and it was like, you don't leave, you don't walk out in the street.
Mm-hmm.
You don't go get in your car. You don't go to work. You leave your apartment. Somebody's going to be out there. They had their entire police force out there patrolling the streets. And if they saw somebody, man, you better run because you were going to get beaten.
Yeah. And I mean, I think it's probably stuff like that that we saw in American news before it got really bad here. And the president we had at the time that probably made it so people here thought, well, we don't do that in America. We don't quarantine and stay inside in America because that's a communist country. We're mm-hmm. a free country. We're a democracy. So we don't have to do that. So, I mean, then we see that over there and we think, well, if it happens here, we're not going to handle it that way. We're better than that.
Well, but, yeah.
I mean,
when I saw that, that's what I thought. I thought, well, I guess I can understand them doing that there the way they do things, but that would never happen in America.
Mm-hmm.
You can't do those things here, and you see how that went. I mean, we couldn't even get people to wear a mask, let alone stay indoors and don't stick your head out the door.
I mean, there's a middle ground between how poorly things went in America in the early days of the pandemic and why everything exploded so fast like it did here, and that kind of treatment of isolation in China. I mean, look at like the UK. They had pretty extreme lockdowns where they closed down all businesses mm-hmm. and had curfews in place where you couldn't travel, you couldn't visit people in other households, like all sorts of stuff. But it wasn't beating people to get them off the streets. You know, there were fines and stuff like that. But they also handled their situation better than we did. So stuff like that, that also I'm sure they left in the hands of public health officials. They said, what do we do to handle this? And they did.
And you didn't have politics involved in deciding, mm-hmm. do we like what those public health officials said or do we not like it?
Yeah.
Let's take a vote.
I'm sure Boris Johnson was probably like not doing a great job over there either, but.
You don't think so?
No.
Well, he caught the COVID.
Yeah. No. Well, so did our Boris, our American Boris.
Yeah. I know what all these leaders, they're supposed to be setting the example. They all caught it.
Mm-hmm.
I think most of them did most everywhere.
Yeah. Yeah, in lots of states, too.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess that's going to lead us into legal briefs.
Was I supposed to say it with you?
Yeah.
Okay. Sorry.
Are you ready?
Let me do it again. Yeah.
I guess that leads us into
legal briefs.
Good. That was your first one.
Thanks.
You did good.
Thanks.
Well, legal briefs is a part of the show where Riley ask me questions, legal questions, if I know, and sometimes I might have one for her to answer.
Oh, man. You're not going to believe this, but I forgot this was a part of the show.
What?
I'm sorry. This was Michael's job.
Well, let me, I'll ask
me
you
well
one.
Enough. Go ahead.
All right. What is it that gives the federal government the right to make decisions concerning concerning transactions that occur between states.
The Commerce Clause.
That's right.
Yes,
you
I did
got
know
it.
That.
That's Santa Claus's brother.
Well,
he handles the money. That's what
true.
It's all about, is the money.
It's
just
true.
Like Jerry Maguire. Show me the money.
What were the, so in West Virginia, we, you know, had that bill that passed the state Senate about public health departments not getting powers, basically. What were the two egregious actions that the people in government said caused this?
Let's see. One had to do with shutting down the vaping centers.
Mm-hmm.
And the other had to do with, was it not letting people from Pennsylvania come over and buy liquor?
Yep. Those were our two egregious actions here in West Virginia.
We're not going to stand for it.
Nope.
What happens when his still breaks down and he don't have no good moonshine? He's got to come over here and buy some of the good stuff.
Well.
Well. See, that's the good part of being one of us here is, you know, we know the vernacular and mm-hmm. we know how things work and we know what's important.
Right. I have one more. Just one.
All right.
So we talked about how we didn't really know where smoking is allowed. And I told you it's not allowed in bars anymore.
Right.
Can't do that.
Yeah.
And I also said vaping isn't allowed because, you know, one of the egregious actions, of course, was we shut down vape shops. But also vaping has become just as dangerous, doctors have said to people, as smoking traditional cigarettes.
Especially ones that blow up.
Well, yeah, those especially. But also, like, for your for your insides. What percent of millennials and what percent of Gen Z do you think e-cigarettes and vapes are harmless?
Is it the same number for each?
No, one is more than the other, millennials and Gen Z.
Which is the youngest of those?
Gen Z. I'm Gen Z, and okay. Like Taylor is a millennial.
Okay. Well, Gen Z probably says that what percentage is dangerous or what percentage thinks
dangerous, they're not dangerous.
Thinks they're not dangerous. Probably Gen Z says 30%.
Mm-hmm.
And the millennials probably say like 60%.
It's actually, 24% of millennials and 20% of Gen Z.
Oh.
And 10% of boomers, but, you know.
Yeah.
They don't really know about vapes.
Am I a boomer or am I too old to be a boomer?
You're a boomer.
Okay.
But I thought that was interesting because I always think of Gen Z, my generation, as being the ones that vape more because they've all those Juuls and Puff Bars and stuff have blown up with my age group.
No, I thought that your age group, that's why I went the other way. I thought that your age group is more aware of these things.
Well,
and it's the millennial age group, like the group that Taylor was in, those are the ones that just blow it out and they don't believe anybody.
Yeah.
They do whatever they want. They're wild and free.
It is interesting, though, that even though less people in Gen Z think they're harmless, mm-hmm. 60% of Gen Zers that vape will say they will continue to vape even knowing the health risks. So even though there are fewer Gen Zs that think they're harmless, that doesn't necessarily mean there are fewer Gen Zs that are vaping. So we are more aware of the risks, but doesn't mean we're stopping.
Well, that's just like the ones that say, well, I don't want that virus, but I don't want to get that shot.
And I don't want to wear that mask.
So by God, it's America.
Yep.
Love it or leave it.
Gonna walk around without a mask and without a vaccine, I guess.
And smoke a cigarette.
And smoke a cigarette.
And vape.
And cross the border into West Virginia to buy liquor.
Thanks to everybody for listening, and thanks to MCRB for use of their song, Dr. Lawyer Indian Chief.
We're proud to be coming to you almost live from Smurl Studios, high atop Three Last Mountain.
And we want to thank Audio Boom for being a part of their network.
And we also want to thank the McElroy Stable Podcast for helping give us our start. Their podcasts include Bim Bam, Sawbones, Still Buffering, and many other fine offerings.
If you have the chance, take the time to rate and review us on iTunes, especially if you like us. And if you didn't, don't bother.
You're not supposed to say that.
You're going to edit that out, though, aren't you?
Why? You never did.
Thanks for listening. This has been Court Appointed. I'm your co-host, Mike Meadows. I'm a lawyer and a dude.
And I'm your other co-host, Tommy Smurl. And I am just a dude. Hello. Welcome to Tommy's Random Thought. Today's random thought is mass shootings. Well, folks, things must be returning to normal. We have two mass shootings within a week. While COVID had been wreaking its own mass casualty event, these types of events had kind of stopped. I don't know whether it was a lack of crowds or uncertainty about what was open or what. It is really confusing why this type of thing suddenly dropped completely off the radar during the pandemic. I would think that people were under a lot more stress and maybe would have been driven to do more of these types of things. I mean, thank God they didn't, but it's still very confusing. So the biggest question is, are we ever going to do anything about it? I honestly think that if Sandy Hook didn't motivate any kind of change, I don't know what kind of event will. About 20 innocent children under the age of like 8 or 9, and all we can do is offer thoughts and prayers. Those same thoughts and prayers are now being offered to those 10 people killed in Colorado for no reason. The main argument is that there is no sense implementing any changes because they probably won't work anyway. You know what? I'm willing to take that chance because the worst that can happen is nothing changes, which is exactly what is happening now. But what if something does work? So the driving force behind this gun inactivity is the NRA gun lobby. The politicians that do nothing and so patriotically protect our Second Amendment rights draw their strength from the dollars they receive from the NRA. Money which comes from the blood of all the people murdered in these mass shootings. The cry of protecting your Second Amendment rights is a hollow lie. They care nothing about your rights to bear arms, as it is a complete perversion of what our forefathers envisioned. They didn't say we want all of our people to walk around with guns unregulated to make our society safer. The NRA, backed by the gun manufacturers, promote that for guess what reason? That's right, to sell more guns to make more money. The NRA has a vested interest in promoting gun use and fighting off any kind of regulation that limits them in any form at all. That vested interest is money from gun makers. Gun makers want to sell more guns. You know why? That's right, money. This is millions and millions of dollars, so they are not going to go down easy. If a few people have to die in order for them to maintain their profits, then they're fine with that. Remember, guns don't kill people. People kill people. The guns are just innocent participants in these events. I say, let's try something new and see if we can make anything positive happen at all. What have we got to lose? It can't get any worse. There is technology available that might make guns more expensive, but it could reduce these tragedies from occurring as well. Guns are plentiful and becoming more so, and with open carry growing in popularity, I don't see things getting better anytime soon. Unless someone can stand up to the gun lobby, or we can get the money out of politics, or whatever we have to do to make people vote their conscience, assuming they still have one. This has been Tommy's Random Thought.
If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key, and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.